So what happened between you and this Renwick customer?
There you go. That's fantastic. That's fine. Stop. Please stop.
Welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 106. It's the 18th of August, and my name is Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Chris Thurston.
And...
Tom Senior.
Tom Senior.
Yep.
And Marsh Davis. And Marsh and Davis. There we are. Oh, God.
It's fallen apart already, Jeff.
Good intro, everybody.
It's a slow news week, so the biggest news we have is that just now, before we began to pod... A new crowdfunding thing was launched by Tim Schafer, Brian Fargo, and a few other people. That the twist is basically like Kickstarter, but it's specifically for games. And the difference is that as well as being able to back at the normal kind of Kickstarter backer level where you pay some money and you get some tat, you can also... Investors can also use this platform so that they can... put money in and get money back when the game is successful, if it is, or lose it if it's not. And right now, that sounds like quite a big difference initially, but right now, in order to actually be an investor to get your money back, you need to be accredited, and apparently to be accredited, you have to have a net worth of $1 million. So, good luck, guys.
An arbitrarily evil number.
But Tim Schafer said that's just for launch, they're kind of working on unaccredited investors. Huh. So basically the idea is that once it's kind of fully operational, you will have the option of getting some tat or actually getting a return on your investment if it's successful.
Right. Hmm. I'm surprised that they would go for that, because surely what they want is investment.
For you not to get
which
the money.
doesn't require them to ever pay you back. Isn't that the ideal scenario that Tim Schafer has been enjoying so far on Kickstarter?
I think they would like to get more money in the first place and to...
Clearly.
I remember like when Notch was kind of jokily and then maybe not so jokily offering to fund Psychonauts 2.
Oh, yeah.
The thing Tim Schafer said at the time was like it wouldn't be like... 2 million, it would be like 25 million or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact figures, but it was something like that, like an order of magnitude more than you would make from a Kickstarter. So maybe that's what he's hoping will happen. Like people like Notch can. Mm.
But isn't this what the market is for? If you go to the city and say, I want investment, and you make a business case, and then you get investors?
I suppose the question is, how many investors are there out there who are not currently like able to invest or willing to invest who would suddenly invest because
exactly,
of this?
Exactly, yeah. In that, a different context. Like,
I sort of think, like, with the accrediting thing needing to be accredited, it's kind of a non-thing right now. Like, there's no difference between that and just having a Kickstarter and also having investors.
Yeah.
But once that restriction is gone and anyone can just put in, like, $100 in the hope of getting $200 out, I don't know if that's how it works, but that could end up being a lot of money. I imagine that there are a lot of people out there who... The reason they don't back Kickstarters at the $200 level is not because they don't have $200 and can't spare it. It's because they think, that's a waste of money, I don't want a fucking poster.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it does fundamentally change the remit of a crowdfunding campaign from back the thing you'd like to see exist that won't otherwise to back the thing you think everyone else will want to buy.
Yeah, that's true. Hmm. Like Call of Duty would kill on this.
Yeah, exactly. It's...
It'll be a new, innovative new... crowdfunding platform that strongly rewards populist, mainstream, conventional safe bets.
Yeah, or like if something is already doing incredibly well, then it'll probably snowball as people kind of see it as a wise or safe bet. Like,
but you're not going to make any profit from this because you just get the amount you invested back, right?
I think you get profit. I think you get a return on your investment.
That's what I'm talking about. That's precisely it. Then Chris is right.
I don't think they've given any details on that yet. Presumably, if you have $1 million, you'll find out. But I don't know, maybe, I suppose one positive from this could be that sometimes people run a Kickstarter campaign and the masses all get behind it and get excited and think, yeah, we own this game and we are making it happen. And then they find out later that actually these guys also took $10 million from this other guy and that other guy wants to control how the game is developed and he has a much bigger say on what happens than otherwise. And maybe this will kind of bring that to light or sort of establish clear guidelines on it. Like, if there's a system for this, presumably built into the system is, in return for backing this, you just get the money and nothing else. Like, there's no influence element.
I theoretically like the idea, because it's just lets people who aren't businesses or don't have a lot of capital invest in something and actually generate profit from a good investment, which is just like a... It's a free market scenario, isn't it? Where, but you know, Kickstarter will exist alongside it, so the Kickstarter stuff will still happen. But doesn't this allow for a new sort of project to exist?
Does it not make people even more vulnerable to losing money on things that they just didn't really have the knowledge or experience as investors to understand this?
Well, yeah. For example, like if a project does incredibly well, attracts this sort of snowballing amount of investors who all think it's going to do incredibly well, but then never happens, which is a risk with crowdfunding stuff.
Yeah,
the loss is that much greater because it wasn't people just putting money into something they wanted to exist. It was people
expecting something.
Tim Schafer is an odd figurehead for this because whatever you think about his games, they've not been without controversy in terms of the level of polish which they received and you know to what extent they fulfilled their Kickstarter remits. So to have a system which is potentially kind of less secure for the people who would be investing in it. I don't know. Maybe it isn't.
They're not lying about what you're going to get out of it. They're not saying that this can't fail. There isn't that problem. Like, they're not going to... Kickstarter projects fail and all the time, don't they?
Yeah, but the traditional path to investment requires a level of knowledge about how to go about investing in things, which probably weeds out people who make really poor investment decisions, which is all of us, probably.
I suppose they'd love that, but...
And investment at a certain level usually tells you access, like usually happens after kind of direct meetings with people and a sort of, you know, being given a level of access to the workings of a project in order to convince you that it's viable and will happen. Whereas this is presumably reduced in most cases to a Kickstarter style pitch video where it's not quite the same thing. It's easier to hoodwink people than if they're coming to your workplace to see it and whatever.
It's going to change the visible economics of what a game needs to get on whatever crowdfunding service in order to be made, because you've got to apportion the amount of the money you've been given as money that's going to be given back, right? And
I'm interested to know what it's like for... I guess, presumably, the people who create the projects can determine the terms of the investment return, like how much they're giving you back if it does do well. The things I forgot to mention are, it's called Fig.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is it called?
And it's launched with one project, which is The Outer Wilds, space exploration game that won the IGF, which is really, really cool. And to be honest, the thing they did, in fact, release that as a game, and it was a really good game. But I guess they're going to expand it. I'm not quite sure how, actually. I haven't been keeping up with what their plans are. But perhaps it will depend strongly on how much money they make on Fig.
Does Fig stand for anything?
Probably.
Funding.
It wasn't.
Funding.
Yeah. I know it's Fig, so that's funding.
See, I'm much more interested in the idea of
investing gamers. topical.
I just did a saucy wink, because that wasn't obvious.
Sorry, Tom.
I'm much more interested in investing in this than I would be in a Kickstarter of it, having played it and having seen the project. And knowing that I would get a copy of this thing anyway, whatever space it ends up in. And the idea of that I would get the Kickstarter promise, but also potentially make some money off it, I don't see any problem with that.
Not yet, though, because you're not worth £1 million, I think.
No, sadly I can't. But
it'd be interesting to see how it does. I would try to look on there, like, because that page is up, you can see all the backer rewards and stuff, but right now it looks exactly like a Kickstarter. There's no mention of investment return stuff.
Right.
Presumably, if you have $1 million just magically waved into that, like it just senses $1 million and just like
that's how the world works. Interesting.
What have you guys been playing?
Well, we've all been playing a game that isn't yet a PC game, but there is a tangential chance that it may one day become a PC game.
It feels like a very PC game.
It really does.
And actually, we did have some tweets asking us to talk about it, so maybe that's.
And it does come from Dear Esther, which was, of course, a mod and then became a thing, and then,
The game is...
Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, by God.
It's by God, where?
Yeah, by the Chinese
room. So ultimately, everyone is.
So I played it all the way through in a single sitting last night, which is probably one of several inadvisable ways to experience that game.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Everybody, I suppose, because I finished it, Tom, you finished it.
Yeah, I finished it in two sittings, and then I watched it. My girlfriend played through it in its entirety, which will become important later because I had very different experiences.
And yeah, Marshy's
yeah, two sittings as well.
Yeah,
everybody's so, played through the Rapture.
Everybody's
we're still here.
Yeah. So it's by the developers of Dear Esther and Amnesia: Machine for Pigs. It is a walking simulator, such as they're known, set in a sort of in an early 80s British village and valley.
Shropshire.
In Shropshire. After some kind of apocalyptic event that resembles the Rapture in that everybody's vanished to be replaced with sort of like ghostly silhouettes that act out scenes from village life in the days preceding this thing that has happened. And it has sort of heavy overtones of like sort of old school British radio sci-fi is probably the way I describe it.
Yeah.
Like, it is basically a radio play, but you walk around.
Yeah.
That's both a praise and a criticism, I believe, of Everyone's Gone to the Rapture. It's much bigger than Dear Esther. It's longer. There's much more to it. It's much more easy to get lost.
How long did it take you?
4 hours, 5 hours, I think. And it's a very different type of story. It's less, even though there are non-realistic elements to the story, it's got a much more grounded and less kind of like otherworldly feel to it. Weirdly, like it has a very specific tone, which feels like that kind of science fiction or that sort of, that type of story. But it's not that kind of like, Dear Esther has this, because you're the one being addressed.
Mm.
It almost has this sort of like, quasi kind of mystical
kind
of atmosphere about it, whereas this really doesn't.
It's worth saying it's definitely not a monologue, and it's not a kind of omniscient narrative voice floating over what you're doing, which is what is in Dear Esther. Here you're actually walking around the village and you're seeing vignettes kind of acted out before you, albeit by these weird ghostly light figures who are meant to be representative of the people who've since disappeared.
And I to preface my criticisms of it, I liked it quite a lot. I think the presentation is absolutely extraordinary. Like, the level of detail in those environments is amazing. It's very evocative of a particular period and type of Britain. Mm. Like, it's Shropshire, but it reminded me quite a lot of...
Or as Pip called it, Shropicana. Which I think is very good.
Nice. Good job, Pip. But it's also reminded me of like the villages that my friends grew up in the New Forest when I was a kid. And like, I think everyone's probably got that point of attachment to certain kinds of British villages, from the perspective. However, I think regardless of your background coming to the game is particularly evocative it's particularly realistic in this depiction of a place, which is quite rare in games generally. Mm. Apart from some abstractions later on, especially in its first environment, it really kind of sells a sort of, a sense of
very, very clean sense of it, which was actually...
Could you set an episode of Midsommar Murders here?
Absolutely, yes.
To play that.
And who the identity of the murderer is would be the most radical plot twist.
Maybe it was you, maybe it was Richard. I can't remember. I was talking to somebody in the pub the other day and they said it should be repurposed as a Midsommar Murders
setting. I actually like that.
I said the same thing to Pip, weirdly.
Oh, maybe I was there.
So much work goes into making these places, and it doesn't have to be... With that level of detail, I don't need it to be a completely fresh place every time, particularly if it's set in the real world. Real world places are quite similar. I'd be happy to see you play like three games set all in this one place.
I think it's a very beautiful setting. Obviously, there's a huge amount of artistry that's gone into it. And sometimes, like, it's so good at some detail. Like, you're walking through a woodland and there's, you know, bluebells, which Pip didn't think were the right colour blue, but never mind, we're fine. And there's a water and mud, and the mud's churned up with kind of boot marks and track marks and the water lying in it. And it looks just, you know, fantastic. It's CryEngine, so it's obviously an engine capable of throwing out really high fidelity stuff. And then you come across a texture which isn't quite right, like the way that water plays on a picnic table, not one of their best textures. And like, but weirdly, it's flip over the table. Except you can't, because you can't interact with anything. But despite all that, and I know some of the ways in which it isn't realistic are intentional. It has a kind of dreamy hyper-reality to it. So there's like a sun setting and it's saturated with this kind of overly kind of pink light and it's meant to have a kind of, I guess rapturous. It is meant to suggest some kind of rapturous moment of of realization, I think, that game, the kind of the way you walk around and experience otherworldly things. So that's intentional, but I also think, like you were saying, Tom, there's just something quite clean, sterile about some of the environments. I don't think it doesn't quite nail it. And I don't really find the game worse for that, because it's pretty fucking good. It's a small team. But yeah, I'm not sure it totally, like, lots of people are saying, this is exactly like Shropshire when I was growing up, and I'm like,
I was going to move on to say the same thing, I think. That, oh, like, right. Yeah. I mean, you could say that it was set in an uncanny valley. But because the thing
is bleeding.
Because it has this thing where, like, for me, what it reminded me of was a TV set. Yeah. Like, almost, it's not just feels like the place where you play a Midsummer Murders game, but like you film Midsummer Murders.
Exactly right.
And I think that's actually almost, it almost works atmospherically, because it isn't precisely realistic. And actually that feeling that it's been frozen in amber, I actually think serves it, because, I had a theory about the plot and your perspective on it afterwards. As I was going through it and you're piecing together what's happened in your head, I had a sort of thought about what's actually happening in the game that answers the realistic, not realistic problem quite well, which I can't really say without spoiling. But like, the point of saying that is that there are, I think, mechanisms in the plot and within the, specifically the atmosphere, because I think stories like that are actually more about their atmosphere than they are about the specific beats of the story. That actually it suits. So even though I think it's absolutely a fact that they bit off this enormous technical challenge of trying to, like, because you feel it, because the first environment you explore is the village centre itself.
Yeah.
And even though you can't go in every single house, the level of detail feels, even if every detail isn't perfect, the amount of details feels massive. Like, the houses, like, for me, the layouts of the houses was the thing that got me, like, knowing, kind of instinctively knowing where things were going to be in those houses, because they're all, like, places that my mates lived in when I was a kid.
They don't necessarily feel lived in, though, some of those houses. But I, you know, this is such a nitpicky thing.
But they're so different to each other. That's the thing. Like, if you accept a certain bar, then, like, no two houses in that game are the same. Like, in terms of the way they're lit, the way they're presented, what's in them, the furnishings. Like, the curtains are different in every single house.
But
like,
it's pointless because you can't touch any of it.
Yeah.
That's like, it doesn't matter how you rearrange the furniture, like, the fact you can't touch any of it already, draw any character or anything out of those areas.
I think there are certainly houses where you do draw a character out of it.
I do think there are ones where
that's not the case. What I was going to say is that first area has, you're kind of encouraged to explore in quite a circular environment where you can take any route through, and the story is sort of designed to play out in different ways based on the route you take. And then after that point, the game becomes notably more linear, with a few exceptions, for quite long stretches. And when I say linear, I mean literally the direction you're following in is a straight road.
Yeah.
And there are times where... And then towards the end, it gets to the point where it starts to repeat assets a little bit. And it's the first time where I felt like it actually fell over a little bit in terms of, this is the limit of what we can practically do given the amount of detail we've committed to. So I absolutely think that there's a degree of overcommitment with just the vast challenge of even this small area of England that they've decided to do in this level of detail, sacrificing, as they did, interactivity and everything else. But I think the story actually survives that. I think that's probably not the reason that it falls down as an experience. Because I think, you know, Tom and I talked about this earlier today. I think actually its big problem is that, unlike Dear Esther, it's a game where you can miss stuff. And this is the core of its gaminess, in a way, is that Dear Esther is a game where you walk through a landscape on a pretty linear path. You can maybe go off in a little horseshoe-shaped loop around in a different direction sometimes, but you're on that road. While you're on that road, the narrator tells you a story, and the exact details of that story change every time you play it, because it picks the lines differently every time, with a small degree of randomization. So that means you don't see everything every time you play, but it also means that you haven't, but not by any fault of yours. You don't see something because you didn't see it, it's just an encouragement to play it again.
Yeah.
Whereas in Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, you absolutely can miss things, and it tries to pull you towards stuff. But Tom, you actually got an achievement for missing everything.
I did. The first time I played through it, so not to spoil anything, but to give a sense of the loose structure of the game, each area you go into has a theme, and that theme crests with a certain narrative sequence that you're supposed to observe. And then there's another beautiful pathway that leads you into the next area, and the next narrative sequence is then crests. But I missed all the crests because I went, I just fucked off into the woods. And I think there's... I've got a lot of problems with just the sheer mechanics of the game. Like the way... What the game... How the game communicates what can and can't be explored. What doors can and can't be opened.
Yeah.
What gates can be opened. What styles can be mounted. Like, that's completely... Very inconsistent throughout the entire game. Mm-hmm. You'll see the same assets and you'll... So you think maybe... Okay, houses with quarantine signs on them you can't go into, but houses that don't have you can go into, but that's not true. You think, oh, maybe doors that are ajar can be opened, but not always. And there are gaps where, like, you go to a pub and you want to go behind the bar, and the gap is clearly wider than you, but you can't go in there, because there are just these invisible, arbitrary walls everywhere you go. And that's compounded by the movement speed.
Oh, God! So I heard the... in the news, basically, there was a controversy about this where they they didn't patch the game. They just issued an update to say, oh, by the way, there is a sprint button in the game, because there's a lot of reviews that dinged it for not having a sprint button.
Mm.
And from an outside perspective, this is hilarious. I'm sure I would be the absolute first person who desperately want a sprint button, but as a kind of, like, walk around and experience emotions game, I was like, where the fuck's the sprint button?
That seems to be logical, but I don't think that's the case. Like, it seems to be logical that by removing the sprint button, you would get people to interact with it in some kind of more sober way. I don't think it's the case at all. I think people engage with stuff more if they feel more embodied, if their actions have more kind of responsiveness. Mm. And I think disabling the ability to run or even just jump, dick around, let people jump on tables and spin about. It really doesn't matter. People can compartmentalize their motion in that world completely separately from the story they're imbibing.
Yeah.
And as long as they feel it's reactive, then they engage with it more. And it so pushed me away when, like, I timed it once. It took me 7 seconds to walk down a flight of fucking stairs. Like, just a set of stairs in a house. I got up, I went to these stairs in my house, I walked down them in 3 seconds, and, like, if I was in a hurry, I could do it a lot quicker than that, probably.
I actually did almost the same experiment with a girlfriend, where it slows you down dramatically indoors.
Yeah.
Which is one thing. But I was I was in a field, and, I said to her, how far do you think it is in this barn between where we are and where that post is? They said, oh, about 5-6 feet. So I got up in that flat, and we raced. We did a very slow race, where I walked, like, just what I considered to be a normal speed. And it was accurate walking speed outdoors.
Oh, right.
But I think we're so trained to move faster in games than we do in real life, because, like, I've done a lot of hiking, and when you're actually moving around at that speed, you're occupied by physical sensation.
Yeah.
And without any of that mild discomfort, and without any of that, you know, the smells and everything else, it becomes boring to look at a painting that moves slowly around you. And that is, like Chris mentioned earlier, in the office, the game world is too big for the speed that you're moving at, it feels. And
so did you guys use the sprint button?
It's not a sprint button. You hold down the trigger.
Very slowly, sorry.
You build up to a speed. I wouldn't say it was sprinting speed, but
ambling, hurrying for a bus that you'll probably still catch. That's the speed. Yeah,
which is, you know, I don't even know that that's really appropriate for the emotional state in which whatever character you are playing would have. Like, I think I'd probably be booking it around that place, trying to look for survivors of whatever apocalypse has occurred.
Yeah.
And, you know, in reality, sometimes I get impatient walking places and run. So, I don't know.
Yeah, putting it that slightly too...
Sorry,
how... I put us on this tangent, so it's my fault. But how I fucked this game up so badly. Like, it doesn't feel like a game you can fail at, but I massively failed at it.
So did I, yeah.
And I don't feel like it's entirely my fault, because these big, open, round environments encourage you to explore, but at the same time you've got this really slow movement speed and you can barely interact with anything. You can't open a lot of stuff that you think you can. And you can get lost, because the guiding mechanism are these flying balls of light that do patrols of areas, and they'll flash at you if you're near them and you can follow them, but they're incredibly erratic about where they go, and, like, it's very hard to discern where they want you to go. And it's one of those games where I realise that I need to be led through it, because if I don't have that hand-holding thing, I fuck the experience for myself completely. Because you can just go into a path and you'll see a scene, and then suddenly you'll go into a completely different area of the game. The entire lighting of the game will change, because, like, the lighting progresses as you go through from area to area. But I managed to find a different way around the kind of crucial point of a map. So suddenly all the lighting shifts very awkwardly into a later stage of the day, and I realise I'm in a completely different section of the game. Everyone's talking about a completely different character in a completely different set of circumstances. And I walk back up the path, and the lighting changes back.
What?
And I'm back in an earlier phase.
No, there is reason for that. It's not just advancing linear time. There is some kind of time thing going on.
There definitely is, but the way you're supposed to experience it, the way you're supposed to transition from time to time, it's via these
chapter breaks,
crucial sequences, which give you the kind of emotional...
Yeah, I was annoyed. I triggered one of those before I really understood why I was triggering this differently from all of the other vignettes that you experience, which are just passive. They just happen. Some of them you need to actively trigger by kind of rotating the control system. And then some of them you need to do that and hold it for a period of time. Then it flashes a lot, and then that's like a chapter end moment.
Mm.
But it's really difficult to work... Unless you've done it a couple of times, you don't have enough data to work out what mechanism it's what the fuck that means. And it was easy to do that once and then realise I hadn't seen all the stuff I wanted to in the village, and then it was difficult to find a way back there because it had locked the way I'd just come. And that, but
To illustrate what Tom said, because I did, I think, the same thing, I'm not going to spoil the environments, but there was an environment I knew was coming later in the game, because Marsh had described it, and particularly told me the atmospheric conditions that it would be found in. And so I got, and that part of the game, the way I arrived at, because often it allows you to get to a new path through a couple of different routes. There are much bigger paths way through the world. And the best way to describe it is, because of the way the game encourages you, makes you worry about missing stuff, it triggered that kind of like mapping part of my brain, the same part of my brain that plays Legend of Grimrock or whatever, or a top-down roguelike where you're constantly kind of remembering what parts you haven't seen. You know, it feels like if I had a mini-map with Fog of War, it would obviously ruin it, but it would actually help you know what you hadn't done. Whereas, like, you know, which what other games do for the same purpose. But you still, someone who plays a lot of games, get that instinct for, like, just space and, like, what parts of that space you haven't been around yet. And often that works by just describing circles around a bit until you've kind of, like, mapped everything out and then you move on to the next bit. Which works in the first couple of areas because it's like a big circle with a really obvious linear exit, pretty much, which is like up a hill. And you're like, I'm not going to go up that hill until I've done everything down here in the valley. Makes sense. Later on, pretty much. Well, I'm saying it's more logical what happens later on.
Yeah.
Because what happens later on is there's an entire chapter that takes place in a kind of its own little area off to the side, basically. And I'd come from a particular direction and it felt like there's a road I hadn't been down that was also in the same direction that I'd come from. So I assumed, I've just entered this chapter, but I'm just going to nip back a little bit to make sure I didn't miss a building or something in the distance. Yeah. But what that actually was the road to the next chapter. So when you go into a new place, it flashes up in, like a title card, basically, some kind of a word to introduce you to the next thing. So it flashed, and this happens every, in an hour gap sometimes. It's a really substantial chunk of thing, and there's only a handful of them in the game. So it flashed up the card, and then I walked 20 feet, and then it flashed up the next card. And I'd completely skipped, like, a fifth of the game.
Wow.
And I went back, which I could do, and I could see that stuff, but it was now using the weather conditions and lighting effects for the next section.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It doesn't change the weather. The part that you told me took place in the rain took place with this blaring orange sunset.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
And from that moment on, actually, I did enjoy it, and I keep, I want to talk about some positives as well. But like, that was the point where I felt like I'd broken it, that I stopped caring a little bit, because it was like, because at that point, it's like, this obviously wasn't supposed to happen. Like, if it was this freeform exploration thing, it wouldn't have shown me the chapter cards twice. Like,
because I sensed the fragility of it while I was playing it. I had a moment where I went somewhere I didn't want to go, then I was able to backtrack, and that was fine. But I thought I'd kind of done as much as I could to fuck it up for myself, because I know for the first part of the game, I was avoiding the kind of flowing the light balls, ball lightning, or whatever it is, that is actually meant to be guiding you between experiences. And I just thought they looked dangerous. So, story balls.
Yeah.
Floating story balls. Yeah, I didn't realise they were story balls. I thought they were nightmarish things of the apocalypse, so I avoided them. But I still managed to put together a really coherent narrative, I think. We should say there's a large number of different stories in there. It's not just one narrative.
Everybody's gone to the Rapture.
Everybody's gone to the Rapture, and everybody has their own little story, you know, because it's a story of an entire village full of people facing death, basically. Yeah. It's like the Archers, but Apocalypse. Archers, Apocalypse.
It is Archers.
Archers Redux.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Archpocalypse.
But I think that was great. And, like, I don't... Not all the writing in it is super. Some of it's really overcooked. And I think some of the sci-fi stuff is, it didn't work for me as well as the rest of it. But when it came down to the kind of little stories of family life that they were trying to resolve hurriedly before everybody dies, I thought that was extremely affecting, you know?
There's some really great moments of drama in it and beautiful moments where like the kind of music kicks in as well. And like that was the thing that broke my heart about getting that chapter break, because there's a really important, when we're marching towards the end now, music cue when we get to that chapter. But it kicked in when I knew I'd fucked it up. Mm. And so that we're marching towards the end now music cue happened as I was fucking running back to the last section. Yeah. But yeah, there's lots of good moments of drama. I liked the sci-fi side of it a bit more as it got on. I think, but yeah, like there's some brilliant, the use of the kind of like, because obviously the big problem these games have is as soon as you show human characters, the limitations of the technology are revealed and the illusion is broken and everything else. And so, you know, most walking simulator narration map games don't have people in them. But this one has these kind of like ghosts of light that kind of act out the scenes. And I think that's actually, even though it's obvious why they've done it that way, I think it's actually quite effective. Because it gives, because I think they're mocap. Like, there's a degree of fidelity to the way people are postured and stuff in those scenes that feels quite real. But you don't have the kind of, you know, oh, that's just a cartoon man problem. It's kind of, the way of traveling the office too, it's a bit like, it's not exactly the same, but it feels a bit like almost like Hiroshima shadows kind of coming to life. Sort of like the aftermath, and this is what's been left of these people. It's just this sort of like ghostly, like light shadow. But yeah,
this is what Tacoma is doing in terms of integrating people abstracted as they are ghosts. Walking around as ghosts that you can't interact with, and they will play out conversations that they had.
But they aren't kind of there physically represented ghosts, are they? They're somehow abstractly represented.
They're sort of projections, yeah, like holograms.
But then they don't look like people, is that right? I thought they looked like shapes or something.
Yeah, well, they're the shape of people, but that's it. There's no detail. They're just colours. Right. So they're like coloured mannequins.
Yeah, I think that's the new go-to indie way of having ghostly cutscenes.
It's funny because it looks like, I feel like we've progressed from copying the audio diaries from System Shock to copying the ghosts from System Shock.
And it has, you know, radios and stuff as well that reveal bits of the plot. And some bits of it are great. Like, some moments of it, like, it has, you know, moments where it actually makes sense why people are actually recording things down and why things are happening on radios. Like, there's actually, you know, it has quite a lot of integrity from that point of view.
Though you do, like, it does have the problem that they're these radios just in the oddest places.
Yeah.
Which
all over the fucking place.
Yeah. Just like on a sun lounger in someone's back garden for no reason. Or a bus stop.
It does feel just a bit collecting off in that point.
And yeah, it is, like, I don't know how you do it, I suppose, but it's there.
I think when it's at its best, it's when you see something and you completely silently infer what's happened and it's kind of horrible or affecting in some way, and you just go like, oh shit, or whatever, like, and that's that. Or you see the aftermath of something that's happened and then the voiceover kind of explains it to you a bit better. Or when you kind of piece a couple of things together, because it asks you to remember a lot of names and relationships between people. Yeah. And then an environmental detail, like scratching on a rock or something, will tell you about something about some characters. And there's a lot to piece together in that regard, even though it is very, very arches, like extraordinarily so, actually. Like
Super arches.
On Twitter yesterday, I think it was Will Porter pointed out that it's quite hard, if you listen to Adam and Joe a lot, the Adam and Joe podcast, it's quite hard to play, dear. Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, because a lot of it involves someone shouting the name Stephen. But more so, I think, because of, for me, because of the Adam and Joe Archers skit, which points out how much they sigh. It's the same as true. Yeah. It is a lot of like,
yeah.
Although the dogs run off again.
We should explain what the Archers is, because this will be like American or not from, not listed to Radio 4, as you might not. But yeah, The Archers is
A radio soap.
A radio soap set in rural Middle England.
Originally designed as a way of giving out good information about farming techniques to people who would otherwise not listen to the radio. So they hook them in with a soap and just spill out good advice about, you know, the right feed to feed cows and stuff.
Yeah.
How long has it been running?
Long time now.
Infinity time.
It's a British institution, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Used to listen to that every night when I was a kid because my dad's addiction to it. So yeah,
and this is that.
Yeah,
but with aliens or something else.
Yeah, everyone's bleeding out of every orifice.
Yes, it's the season finale of the Archer. Yeah. That will never come.
Yeah, Archer's Apocalypse is a good way of. Yeah, it's like a cross between Archer's and like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Mm.
But I think as it drags on, I don't think it actually satisfactorily resolves a lot of that stuff.
The individual plots of people?
There's many of them in some ways. Some of them are beautiful and some of them aren't. But actually, I've never found, and I'm the person, I think, typically, when we have these kinds of discussions, who can sort of empathise with any character in anything and be a big softie about it. I fucking hate the main guy in Everyone's Gone to the Rapture.
He's a prick, yeah.
He's a total fucking tool.
Is this the person you play as?
No, it's not. No. Well, like...
I expect that to be a complicated question.
Who you are and why you're there is a,
but it's a mystery. I said no, then didn't realise that I'd spoiled a mystery, but no.
It'd be interesting to have if on a podcast where everyone had played it, then we could talk about who you are and why that's possible.
Yeah, because I have a theory about that explains a whole bunch of the other problems. But like,
you're the ghost from Gone Home.
But there's a point where it still sort of seems to want you to sympathise for a very, very key focal character. And I just think he's a fucking giganto tool. And I had no empathy for him whatsoever.
He is a shit, but I think that's kind... I thought that was one of the more acceptable kind of things in it.
For me, he was an unbelievable shit. The first time you see him, he tells us like an innocent man who's just like locking a gate to go fuck himself for like no reason. Yeah. Well, you see him, hear him.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose... But maybe they're the two first people you meet. One of the, like the, clearly the drama is centres around this character Stephen and Kate, his wife, who are both scientists who work at the observatory, and I found both of them to be the least interesting, offering the least interesting drama. Actually, Kate redeems herself to some extent. It's not that I disliked her as a character, as a fiction. I just didn't find myself as engaged by their drama as I did by the other smaller dramas carrying the village.
They're carrying a lot of the expository backdrop that actually lets the other characters have their moments. They're doing it so you don't get that much time with them, so they have to do all of the background stuff to enable Wendy to have her moment and everything.
I really like Wendy. Yeah, the voice cast of all the people who do good rural accents is awesome.
I want to say that it's one of the best sounding games I've ever played.
Yeah, I think you should get an award for sound design. Yeah. Actually.
Do you think so? I thought the way that the sound was recorded could learn something from the Archers, actually. When you listen to the Archers, they do make an effort to make people's voice acting sound like it's occurring in the conditions in which it's meant to. Whereas here it always sounds like it's coming from a speaker 4 feet from your head.
Maybe they have to account for lots of different conditions where the player's standing when that happens, though. Yeah, that's why it's so high in the mix, you have to hear it.
They have to pump it up after. Like, they don't know what the precise ambient condition is going to be for each skit, necessarily. Like, it depends when you're recording, when you're developing. So if you're recording...
Just play it. I'm sure there's... I thought sound design in games was sufficiently sophisticated now, where it would actually... play the sound live within that environment and then reverberate, and then the sound as it emanates within that environment would be the one that's then played to you as the player. Does that not happen? Half-Life.
That's quite a big technical debt, though.
You can apply, depends what effects you want, but you can apply filters like a high-pass filter or a low-pass filter to kind of cut the treble or cut the bass, depending on,
But I think Half-Life 2, when you're listening to somebody talk to you, when you're in Battlefield, when you're in somewhere that echoes, the sounds echo. And it doesn't echo in this. It all sounds very kind of, this was recorded in a sound booth.
But I think it's very deliberately intimate, because they're not corporeal beings. They're, glowy light shapes. And I think that they're supposed to sound intimate and supposed to sound close to you and inside your head, as though you're almost...
Right.
Hearing their thoughts. And I think actually it's very, I think a lot of vocal performances are excellent. Mm. Really, really strong, unusually strong for a video game, especially. And I think particularly for the more tearful moments, that kind of intimacy, that closeness to the mic and that dryness actually was incredibly effective and gave more room to the score, which is extraordinary.
Amazing.
It's unbelievably good, the soundtrack to this game. And I'd buy that separately for £12.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, beautiful music.
Choral music, I should assume, is made entirely for the game.
Yeah, I think it was all bespoke. It's even just beautiful little kind of piano movements that just subtly happen when you transition between areas. They're not even crescendo moments for the story, but they're just kind of transitional moments to keep you in a certain mood. And that stuff's all absolutely, absolutely fantastic. And I actually love the way the voices are recorded. I think just the quality and the crispness of the recording and how warm the voices are really, really help the quality of the acting come through and penetrate the kind of ambient soundscape that a lot of games favour. I love the way it sounds.
Stephen! Just coming!
But yeah, no, I agree with Tom. I think it sounds brilliant.
It's good. It's really good. We can complain about it. Like,
I think it's really good, but it has its severe problems. And like, it's...
I don't know how I'd have solved all of them, though. Like, no, with that budget, I think, with that ambition.
I think it's something the players can help themselves with by taking breaks. Like, I think I suffered from having played it through in a go, and you really get tired of it, and you start to fade a bit, but yeah.
Tom, everybody who's should go. Looking tired and possibly fading. Tell us about StarCraft.
Yes.
2. Wow.
Ah, there's light. I have been playing StarCraft 2 Heart of the Swarm because of a weird thought process, starting with watching the International Dota tournament and thinking, like, I don't enjoy watching Dota as much as I enjoyed watching StarCraft 2. And I thought, God, I really enjoyed watching StarCraft 2. Wow, I should definitely watch StarCraft 2. And one of the things that was kind of... I'm not really sure why I stopped, but I think one of the things that was getting exciting when I stopped watching it was that Heart of the Swarm had just come out, and that changed all the meta, obviously. Like, everyone's using the new units and stuff, and they're just kind of batshit. And so I started by... I suddenly realised, oh, actually, I never played that game. I meant to play that game. Like, I quite enjoyed the single player of Wings of Liberty, which was the main campaign that it launched with, and I really like Zerg, so I should play this. And it's quite good, but I have a huge problem with it, and it's the same problem I have with Wings of Liberty, and I have this problem so acutely that it's almost comic, and I can't believe that not everyone has this. I can't believe that Blizzard didn't have this and they didn't solve it, because it's quite easily solvable. And it's that both Wings of Liberty and this have a good progression structure. So between missions, you go back to your base and you upgrade things. You can, like, now you can improve the way this unit works and you can upgrade this. And with Zerg, they go even further with that. And you can, you have both temporary, changeable upgrades. Like, each unit, you have 3 different options for how to mutate it, and you can change that at any time. You can just say, I want to try longer range now. And then you say, oh, that wasn't so good, so next time I'm going to try this other upgrade. And you can change that without any cost. And then at special moments, you go on a whole mission to evolve a unit into 2 different branches of it. And it's awesome, and it gets you really excited about, oh, now that I upgraded my brooches in this way, and then I combine it with this other trait, they're going to be unstoppable. And you think, I can't wait to get into a StarCraft game so that I can use these units in that way. And then you play the next mission, and you are controlling a Terran battleship in an asteroid field. And you must fight off, like, swarms of fighters, and then capture certain points, and then it ends. And it's just a completely different game. And the next mission will be a completely different game. The next mission will be a completely different game. And so far, I'm 18 missions in. I've never been allowed to just build a base and attack another base. That's never come up.
You might get to do that to an extent in the final mission.
Yeah, so that was true in Wings of Liberty. The final mission, you got to... It was actually, like, fighting a base, but then their base was so insanely overdeveloped that it was nothing like a kind of actual skirmish match. And what I want is just a boring, straightforward mission. I want a base, and I want them to have a base, and I want to build my base, and I want them to build their base, and then I'll attack them with all the cool units I've got. I'm so excited to do that, and it just never happens. It feels like a campaign that's made for people who are just sick to fucking death of StarCraft, who never want to play StarCraft again. And they started on the premise, okay, we can never ever do a mission that's anything like a StarCraft match. There's always got to be completely unique, bespoke stuff. And it requires an extraordinary amount of effort and design, and it's incredible, like, heroic, Herculean, like, amount of work. But I don't know when I've done it. I just want to play the game. I want to play StarCraft with these cool units. Because all of the upgrades feel designed for the only way you can kind of plan your upgrade strategy. It invites you to think about how this upgrade is going to combine with that one. And if I make my roaches have self-healing and my mutas have self-healing, then I don't need Kerrigan to take the upgrade that heals all the units around her. And so I can therefore choose the alternate upgrade in that slot, which is to summon 6 Banelings, which is an amazing, cool, dramatic thing. And my Banelings are upgraded so that they'll jump through the air, and then they're also upgraded so that when they explode, they have double splash damage, a double splash radius. And both those things are amazing. And then the next mission just will not contain an opportunity to do that at all. Or the next mission gives me no base at all. Kerrigan's alone on a ship, And every now and then it gives me like a few Zerglings or some other units that I don't want, and the roaches don't show up, and you desperately need her healing ability because they just get whittled down and none of them can heal because they're not the units you would have built. And so I just had to cancel the mission, go back and pick the healing ability and try again. Because you don't know what the mission's going to be. Mm. You get like, you know where you're going, and it gives you a rough description of like what you might unlock when you finish it, and you get the plot reason for being there. But it doesn't tell you you're going to be Kerrigan alone on a ship, and you'll have only she'll be the only way you can heal the units that you're with.
Right. Yeah.
So it's this weird chain of special cases, and I wouldn't mind. Actually, I'm actually fine with the individual ones because they're quite well made, and they're not so hard that they're frustrating. And there's always like optional objectives, which means you can kind of choose how much challenge you want to take on, which I really like. And if it was just one of those, and then a standard mission, and then one of those, and then a standard mission, it would be perfect. I'd absolutely love it.
You should play Computer Theorist 2 expansion, Ardennes Assault, which I've been playing this week as well, which basically you get three companies of Americans in the Ardennes region, and you get a map of territories, and you choose where your armies go, and you get sort of graded between missions. And sometimes the missions have special objectives, like there'll be drops from the sky that you have to send people to grab. And sometimes there will just be standard fights where there's a base over there and you've got a base and then off you go.
Right.
And so that actually strikes a good mix and achieves what you're describing.
Because Dark Crusade is like an expansion pack for Dawn of War that had a strategy map and individual skirmish maps.
Mm.
And it was too far in the other direction where, I mean, I actually still loved it, but it was each territory on the strategy map that you want to conquer, you just play a skirmish game that's like on a completely unrealistically symmetrical map designed for multiplayer, the kind of things you use in tournament play, where it's designed for balance and nothing else and doesn't look anything like a real place.
Yeah.
And then those are exactly the same. And then sometimes the strategy map is such that you just have to play the same map again because that territory has been invaded just after you took it. So you play literally the same map in the same circumstances. And at times that got stupid because it was just, it was literally replaying the last match you did. But like when it was just conquering a bunch of territories, playing a bunch of skirmish games and slowly building up like an entourage of units that you start with, that was awesome. But it would have been way better if it had anything like as complex and as sophisticated a system of upgrading your stuff as Heart of the Swarm has.
Yeah, the only problem with the Ardennes Assault thing is that they solved the problem of the counterattacking Chaos Forces in by not having the Nazis ever counterattack or do anything. So when you beat a region, you see the little Nazi symbols flee to you know, surrounding regions, which is great because if you have an area surrounded, they all just get deleted. They all die if that happens. So it encourages you to move tactically, but they never proactively strike back at your areas, which actually kind of solves the problem. It's a really satisfying campaign because of that. But you are just punching a child into the dust.
For some reason,
it's never going to be
punching
any
a Nazi child.
It's never going to be any response or.
For some reason, when you describe that, I'm picturing the Dad's Army map.
The arrows,
kind of, yeah, the comedy arrows
being pushed back.
So also watched the GSL because like after watching the international and think this isn't as good as watching StarCraft 2, then playing StarCraft 2 and thinking this isn't as good as watching StarCraft 2, I decided why not just watch some StarCraft 2, and I watched the last GSL like finals. I watched the semi-final and the finals, and the finals game is amazing. It reminded me of to some extent I'm just more familiar with StarCraft, but also I think it is a bit clearer what's going on, and just. It's 1v1 as well, so it's just kind of a lot more mind games, at least are apparent to me. This pairing is just amazing. One of the first match that they have is like best of seven. And the very first thing the guy does is is it a cannon rush or was it a proxy gate? It was one of the kind of mad cheese strategies that you do, and that was game one. And then in game two, he did a cannon rush, which is where you just run to the enemy base and build a cannon right in front of it, and try and do as much damage as you can. And one of the ways out of it is that the enemy can expand and take a new base and kind of focus on that one. And the Zerg did that, and the Protoss built another cannon there, and then the Zerg expanded again, and the Protoss built another cannon there. He built four cannons on four different bases. So he basically did the cannon rush four times and like invested all of his money into it. And so the whole game was just nuts. Like almost every game, the commentators were saying, we've never cast a game like anything like this. This is completely bizarre. And during the cannon rush one, the commentators are Tasis and Artosis, so I think
they're
brilliant. They're kind of the reason I like watching StarCraft 2. And Artosis was saying, this is like the first time I ever played StarCraft and I didn't know how to play it and I thought the turrets were really good and I just put them everywhere. And the other thing I said was, this is like the top level of StarCraft 2. These are the best players in the world duking us out. But somewhere in Silver League, this exact game is also happening.
Grand finals, man. Nothing makes sense in grand finals.
Yeah.
Clutch strats. Pocket strats.
You were playing something else much.
Yeah. I know some of those now.
Yeah. I've really got to tell you about this game. I've been so excited to tell you about this game for a long time because it's the fucking balmiest thing I think I've played in ages. I was actually turned onto it by an article on PC Gamer. Chris Livingston did a quiz about the stupid things that you may or may not see in this game. You had to guess true or false.
Oh yeah,
and it's fucking odd. Blues and Bullets is a game. It's sort of like, I suppose it's like a Telltale sort of choice and consequence thing with a detective theme. But it's as though it was a Telltale game directed by Tommy Wiseau. it's tonally one of the strangest things I've ever come across. And like it's quite polished in a lot of ways. It's like quite an accomplished technically game, not really mechanically sophisticated or interesting, but like the it works, you know, at a functional level. It's really kind of nicely done. It's got a kind of black and white art style with accents of red all over the place. You play as real life cop Elliot Ness, who you may remember from the film The Untouchables, played by Kevin Costner, where he was playing Elliot Ness, who was a 1920s cop who took on Al Capone and successfully. Well, I mean, I don't know that. I think in the film it makes it look like he brought down Al Capone, but he did a lot of damage to Al Capone's operations by shutting down his Prohibition era alcohol stills and things like that. But I think actually Al Capone was eventually done in for tax evasion, by a different investigation. Anyway, point is, that actually happened, but in this you play as Elliot Ness sometime in the future, not sometime in the future from now, but sometime in the future from then, in an alternate reality in which he is now a short order chef working in a diner, and Al Capone lives on a dirigible. Which is not even slightly the weirdest thing about it. And
where does Al Capone live on a dirigible?
It's totally not explained. It's actually the Hindenburg.
not just any dirigible.
No, it hasn't caught fire in this reality. Although there is a picture of it catching fire on one of the walls, which is, I don't understand what's going on.
It was fine.
But he lives on this dirigible where there
Oh, it's fine, that man shouted.
The safety!
Where there is an upcoming performance of a Shakespeare play, Titus Andronicus, and there's a circus act with a guy throwing knives at a woman, and you can go up and tap the guy on the shoulder as he's throwing a knife, and you hear a scream, and then he's sitting down crying afterwards.
Oh my god!
It's completely. It's like, I don't know. The rest of the game played completely straight. This is a game in which at one point a character says, completely straight faced, "Sorry to butt in, I've brought your rapist costume for the party." And at one point, when Elliot Ness is giving, he has to give an alias to a lady at reception, and so he gives the alias Mr. Untouchable.
As in the film Untouchables.
As in the film of The Untouchables. It seems to be played completely straight. Like, I just don't understand. It's very, very, very strange.
How do you interact with it? What's the actual kind of...
Well, the premise is that as a short-order chef, you are now hired by Al Capone to investigate the disappearance of his granddaughter, who appears...
What, but you're a chef?
It doesn't explain why you became a chef.
Why did you start that sentence with, as a chef?
Short order chef, though, when so the makes sense.
One of the first decisions you need to make in the game as Alien Ness is how much hot sauce to put on a burger.
But that makes sense, you're a chef.
Well, yes, exactly. But then, yeah, Al Capone says, well, you know, you've got to come and work for me now, and you can punch him, but then still work for him. And he's always playing the piano for some reason. And
Al Capone.
Al Capone, really good pianist. He doesn't have syphilis in this reality either, which is the famously how he ended his life as a syphilis-riddled old man. His daughter's been kidnapped, presumed by an organisation involved in occult blood sacrifices.
Why does he need to do this?
Because he's corrupted the rest of the police force is the implication, and you're the only straight cop.
So even they're so corrupt they can't work for a man
who's corrupted.
I've ruined the police force. They're just
they're
assholes.
Triple
now.
Corrupt now.
They went way past corrupt into just jerks.
Yeah, and so you agree to do this, and then you follow some leads. And actually, the investigation mechanic for how you pace through crime scenes isn't bad. Like, it's the rest of the game, you're given these kind of choices, which are completely arbitrary, like, how much sauce do you put on somebody's burger? Or, you know, stuff like, do you punch Al Capone? And he's okay with it. and all this stuff. But it seems like occasionally there is a decision which might make some difference later. Apparently there's going to be branching paths in the story. This is the first episode of five, I believe.
Episodic fucking hell.
Yeah. exactly like a Telltale game. And but the way you pace crime scenes is quite interesting. You go up to things, you look at them, and you gather clues, and you can switch back to this kind of evidence board thing, where you need to kind of put the right clues in the right places for the right bits of evidence. So actually, it works better than, say, L.A. Noir's thing, I think. Mm. It's still kind of a bit simplistic, and sometimes he makes leaps of logic that seem slightly absurd, but... it's quite horrible as well. Like, the crime, this guy has been skewered like a voodoo doll with lots of bits of railing, and he's had his hands ripped off, and his hands are found in the bathroom, kind of weaved together, and then you can unfold them finger by finger, and he's got his teeth inside them.
Oh my god,
he's pretty cool.
sweet.
But yeah, that doesn't really sit alongside the I missed it untouchable stuff, or
what party are they going to?
Oh, well, this is getting spoiler territory if I explain the rapist party. actually, that's the point at which the episode ends, so...
you don't find out how the party goes.
Well, you get in your costume, but you don't manage to get in...
You get in your rapist costume.
Yeah, but you don't get to go in the submarine, which is where the party's being held.
What does the rapist costume look like?
It looks like...
Because if there's a clear uniform, it would solve a lot of problems.
It's a guy with bandages all over his face.
It's a mummy.
Oh my god. ancient Egyptian rapist.
a low-life thug does make that joke to you, actually.
What? So, that doesn't resolve the problem. They're making a lampshade on it doesn't make it not a mummy.
There are reasons he's got bandages.
Okay.
That makes more sense than some of the other things.
You've got to be there.
In the game.
Why is he... Well, actually, one of the better questions is why does he have to wear dress as a rapist to go to this party?
Well, again, that's you don't need to spoil it.
Okay,
It's essential playing. And you spend the rest of the game drinking juice. if you choose to. You can drink whiskey. I chose to drink juice. I was just feeling like juice. But unless you know that Elliot Ness had some alcohol problems later in life, it kind of doesn't mean anything. So you're just like drinking all the juice. And one of the characters is like, breathe on me. I'm like, what? Why would I... Well, I breathe on you. Honestly, she's checking to see if you've been drinking, but without establishing the prior context of his drinking habit, that just seems very, very strange as a request. the whole thing, completely fucking barking, really, really odd. I think it's transcendently stupid. I really enjoyed playing it. I'm going to play some more of them.
This is a recommendation, then?
Yeah, totally. I think it's... I really hope that they make their money back, because it's... What a fucking strange thing to play.
Should we do questions?
Hell yes!
Why not?
Yes.
That's a consensus. Anonymous writes, Dear Creighton Crowbar, with regards to your question a few weeks ago about why people play free-to-play or play-to-win games, it appeared nobody replied, I thought I would tell you about why I play War Thunder and the amount of time and money I've put into that game. I'd like to preface what I'm going to say about my enjoyment of the game by saying that I've played it for 14 days, 17 hours, 3 minutes in match time. Not including single-player things and looking in menus. I've also spent, I think, over £300 as I hired someone to play on my account for me.
Wow.
In the greater scheme of the game, currently I have about a third of the content unlocked. The reason I believe this game to be comparable to Cow Clickers and Clicker Heroes and the like, presumably, is that the game is almost no fun at all, as it's very unbalanced. I believe the question he's referring to is when we asked people who actually enjoyed this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that the game is no fun at all, because it's very unbalanced. The reason I've put the time and the money into it is because I enjoy having the bigger, better thing than my friends, even if I don't use them, because there's a completionism to it. Not that I play it personally, but that's the same reason that some of my friends... It's a different game. Not that he plays it personally, but it's the reason that some of my friends have put 1,000s of hours into Clash of Clans. Just his opinion. From the pre-play idea, I have a question. When you review an MMO with grinding, how do you measure how difficult it is to get to the endgame content, which is often the bit people want when you have press accounts with everything unlocked, as I presume you don't, in fact, play the game for 2 weeks straight? Thanks for listening to someone reading this out, everybody. Anonymous. Well, on the MMO thing, we actually do just play it for 2 weeks straight. There is no press account with everything unlocked almost any of the time, and most of the time you wouldn't take it if there was. So.
I remember when I was starting out as a freelancer and obviously very keen to get work, I would always be given the MMO jobs because they're the worst jobs and they're just not worth the money. But if you really want to make a name for yourself, you just do it anyway. You do just play them fucking many, many hours.
That was an amazing story.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I admire the honesty. I think a lot of people would not admit that is the reason that they...
Well, he did admit it anonymously.
but even then, it's like that is a lot of... I think that strikes the heart of why a lot of this is vanity.
Is he saying he actually played for 14 days and then paid £300 for someone else to play extra time in addition to that?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, otherwise that's a shit day rate for him.
It's, and then he doesn't like the game. It's this terrible, unbalanced piece of shit.
But if all your friends are playing it...
But he's got the best stuff in it.
Some kind of social...
But not even the best stuff, he's only unlocked a third of the stuff. He's the £300 and 14... Yeah, I suppose so. But what I... Do you know this game, War Thunder?
I've not played it.
Isn't it like
it's basically an attempt to take on the World of Tanks.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. I couldn't remember if it was like that or World of Warplanes. I think it's like both, isn't it?
It's a bit of both, yeah. There are ground vehicles, there are planes as well. I think they're playing, or already have added ground combat as well.
It's funny because I always...
There's a plane right there.
Even with the Star Citizen stuff, where people are spending hundreds of pounds on spaceships that don't exist, even in the virtual sense... I've always been assuming that they are justifying us themselves by saying, but when the game's done, it's going to be a great game, and they just believe it's going to be an amazing game. But this suggests that's not even necessary for them to want to spend that money and to care about what they have. You can care about what you have in a universe that you think is shit. You don't care about.
It's nice to spend money. Nice to have stuff.
If you've got a community of friends around you and there is some sort of social currency to what you're buying into, maybe it has that extra value. But then...
If you spent those £300 paying someone else to play, the people who make the game must be... like, kicking themselves, because that's a person who's willing to spend £300 on the game to get some cool stuff, and they obviously didn't give him the right way to do that, because he felt the need to pay, presumably breaking the game's terms of service, for someone else to do it.
Reminds me of the EVE Online updates, where they added the Captain's Quarters, which were these... this is when EVE was thinking about moving into, actually personifying players, giving them avatars and letting them interact in bars and spaceports, and they've moved away from that enormously, because community backlash. But their first iteration of it was just a tiny, lonely bedroom where you dress up and no one sees you. And they sold a load of items around this, and they're entirely pointless because no one sees you. And the point of those items is that you get to perform an identity in a social situation that matters to you, like EVE Online community and EVE Online Corp. But no, you're just there. They put two mirrors in there so you can see your £60 monocle.
They actually literally sold a monocle, right?
They did sell a monocle. Most controversial item. It's very expensive.
Well, it's up front. It's, if you want to have an item that typifies buying something just to show that you can buy it, a monocle is the way to go.
Yeah.
Top hat, little silver car.
Literally be Monopoly Man.
James Clayton writes, "Dear Craters, Tooth and Tail looks great for a whole host of reasons, not least of which is the soundtrack they're describing as drunken pirate communist music." Which, if you like that, you should really go to Bristol. Monaco, The Banner Saga, Sunset. Austin Wintry is the first composer whose name alone will have me pre-ordering any game he's worked on. Are there any sound artists about whom you feel similar? Also, can I afford a PS4 just to finally play Journey? Thanks. Keep on podding, everybody. James.
Tooth and Tail does look good. It's the...
I don't know anything about it.
It's the action RTS by the people who made Monaco. And it used to be called... Lead to Fire, or Lead to Fire, and the fact that I don't know how to say it is one of the reasons they changed the name. They said they were really pleased themselves when they came up with it, because we read about like 8 different ways in terms of like, are you leading your people to fire, or were they led to fire, or is it lead like bullets, and is it fire as in burning fire, or is it fire as in shooting a gun? And then they found like just everyone was saying, how do you pronounce it, what do you say, what does the word mean, what are you talking about? And so now it's called
Lead to Fire.
Now it's
to Lead to Fire.
No, is it Tooth and Tail? Or
It's Tooth and Tail.
Yes.
Or Tooth and Tail, depending on which part of Britain you come from.
Which is presumably a pun on Tooth and Nail, and also a obtuse reference to the Tooth to Tail ratio, which is a military term.
Really?
For how many soldiers you have per staff that you need to supply them. The tail is the supply line, and the tooth is the soldier.
Oh my God. If you have like tail is something different. But yeah.
Okay, you're on a tail.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Well, okay. That sounds pretty
good.
Nor
did I until I mentioned it was a reference to that, and then I looked up.
Do you have musical people that you would buy a game for?
No, I tend to just really like individual soundtracks, and then I mean, I really liked Jesper Kidd's stuff on Hitman, and I remember that name coming up often enough that I remember that I started to think, oh, that's a composer I really like. But actually, like, the demands that are put on composers are so different for each game that it's possible for just the person who wants the soundtrack to be made to ruin it for me by picking a style I just don't like.
I think I'll probably buy any game which has Jessica Curry doing a soundtrack now, though. Probably because they're all going to be for the Chinese Room, of which she is a founder. They're an interesting studio anyway. But also Mark Canham, who did the Far Cry 2 soundtrack, I'd certainly be interested in other games he's done. Eamon Tobin as well, but that's because I'm a bit of a nut for Eamon Tobin.
I think I used to feel that way about Danny Baranowski.
Who's that?
I did Cannibalt and
Super Meat Boy
and Super Meat Boy and Binding of Isaac, and there was a run of like brilliant indie games from 5-6 years ago, which he did, but I haven't really listened to his stuff since. I'm sure he's still brilliant. It's not that he's changed; it's just that was definitely a case of like moving into actually we'd probably get a soundtrack. Probably anything that any of the music on any of Supergiant's games will probably always be a big part of the sell of their stuff for me.
Is that Darren Corb?
It's Darren Corb. Who but I think they always collaborate with other musicians, don't they? They bring in other people.
Certainly on Transistor, they had a vocalist for the singing bits.
Was it the same vocalist as the singing bits of Bastion? Because it sounds like it might be. I don't know. Anyway, that's a case of, I guess, the composer in that case, but more that I'll always be interested in their games because the music's always going to be rad, regardless of what particular game they're. Tom,
I can't think of any at the moment. I would have actually put together a long list for this. I'd have paid attention to the question before the podcast. So I might come back for a future one with a list of people I love.
Good idea.
I'm obviously very keen to hear the future work of Ryan Eich, John Robert Matz, and Francisco Cerda, the three composers of Gunpoint, who all do very different stuff.
So, next question. We're actually about to blow this guy's mind. Paul writes, Dear Crepe and Rhubarb, he starts off with, not really a question, but I just wanted to mention that the increase in audio quality over the last few weeks has been marked and most appreciated. Well done. Now that you're all swimming in Scrooge McDuck levels of Patreon wealth, we'll be seeing the return of the keenly missed Dark Souls 2 playthrough. There's plenty of baddens left who have yet to rue the motherfucking day, and it would be a terrible shame to leave them that way. Love the show. Paul. So Paul will be gobsmacked to discover that we've changed literally nothing at all yet about the way the podcast is recorded at all.
We've moved close to the microphone. We've changed some EQ settings, but microphones are on the
cards. We haven't actually got through the Patreon money yet. A month before it can be released to us.
But we've got a plan, and it's going to sound fucking awesome.
But yeah, so maybe. I'm glad that last week sounded good. I mean, last week we were in a different room.
Oh yeah,
yeah, different we things to affect using it, like what computer it's plugged into.
I have been using the equalizer settings sent to us by somebody who knows what the fuck they're doing.
Really? Yeah.
Whose name I forgot. Otherwise, I would thank him personally. But they did sound better. I think maybe I don't know.
Last week I did it and I didn't use those. I just used the same ones I've been using all the time. Yay. I never had new ones.
The thing is, what it shows us is that we can just tell you it sounds better and you'll believe us. So
keep on believing, Paul.
Yes, this is a really smart and insightful podcast. Worth paying for.
Patreon.com.
But yeah, we're happy to get separate mics and do it properly. Yeah. And it's,
what's the other thing that we're going to do properly, Tom?
That's the thing that I'm going to very publicly take complete responsibility for, which is there's a key segment of Dark Souls 2 videos that I need to edit and actually get up, and I just haven't.
How many months have gone by?
Oh, it's been a while.
Has it been eight? I think it might have been 8 months.
I'm really sorry. But
is that more than half a year?
If you do it by the maths, it does seem to be more than half a year.
If you do the maths.
Half a year's worth of time.
They, they will be worth the wait, because some motherfuckers will rue the day, and you will see those videos.
Slanton returns on some of them as well.
He does. So. We do some PvP and stuff. It's fucking awesome. And I'm just using this as a trailer now. And now, like, now I've publicly said it, and it's on the podcast. I must fucking do it. So that's good.
Tom is also editing this episode, so he can just take out his own promise.
It's a very good point. But the fact that if you hear
or
this,
is he editing this episode?
It'll just be me talking. It'll just be a monologue. Yes. So that's it now. That's it. I'm bound to it. Yes. Sorry, Marsh.
We were younger men when that Dark Souls video series was embarked upon. I put the paper down in the middle of that section. I shouldn't have done. Kane writes, "Sup. I decided to try the newly released Hacknet, having been a fan of Uplink back in the olden times. Discovered that if you're unusually diligent in undertaking a particular assignment, you can complete it in a way that opens up what appears to be a path for a black hat storyline instead of the game's normal white hat one, a bit like what Uplink had, but much earlier in the story. The white hat path appears to be to join a professional cybersecurity group named CSEC, presumably employing grumbly alien birdmen. The black hat path asks you to hack into the website for terrible antivirus software maker Norton, spelt Nortron in the game. Great, lawyers will just fucking be blinded by that. And plaster the word dicks all over it. I chose to complete this assignment by changing Nortron Security Services to Nortron Dicks Services.
Good, I approve, Kane.
What's your favourite example of an Easter egg in a game leading to otherwise unavailable narrative content? Also, remember eggs.com? That still exists, you'll be happy to know, and still looks mostly like the 90s. Dicks! Kane. That's a really good story, but unfortunately probably the most specifically worded question we've ever received.
So, white hat is when a hacker works for a security firm, right?
It's when they're like a good hacker, and black hat is when they, like, go to the Empire.
So was there... I didn't actually know of any Easter egg in Uplink about this. Can you...
No.
Switch sides in Uplink?
Not in Uplink, but this is Hacknet, which is...
Yeah, you've sent, it's a bit like the Easter egg in Uplink.
Oh, is there?
Is there?
But
no, I don't know.
Maybe
there is? Yeah, the poor naming conventions of Hacknet extend to EOS, which is a type of phone that you can hack. And the security of that phone is ridiculed in Hacknet.
EOS, like... Is the E like a little E, and the OS is like a big O and a big S?
It's not that explicit, but... But nonetheless,
it's a really interesting thing. I think it's cool when there's a sort of radically different way to play a game that's in some way hidden like that. Unfortunately, I feel like there's one game that I have that I do know about that does that, but I can't think what it is.
I suppose you could maybe vaguely put like the ending of Far Cry 4, where you just do what Pagan Min says and sit in that room.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And then you fly off in a helicopter, and the game ends.
Start it. Yeah,
I think that is pretty cool.
That's an Easter egg. Really,
what's the game where you can...
That actually might be the one I think of.
Yeah, what's the game where you can? It's the game where you can kill yourself right at the start, and it does actually give you an ending.
Portal 2 had many endings.
Yeah, that's true.
In its initial iteration.
I went to eggs.com. I didn't know it back in the day, but the Easter egg I read there was that in Portal 2, Portal 1 actually, if you wait long enough before destroying a final orb in the Garrosh fight, then the game doesn't know whether you're alive or dead, and so you get a weird kind of like bastardized version of the ending where some bits of it play and some bits don't. It didn't sound like an Easter egg to me. It sounded like a bug.
Yeah, sorry. Good anecdote. We're there's shit. We're not shit, and we answered that question perfectly.
There is something you can do in Far Cry 2. I never actually finished Far Cry 2, so I can't speak to it properly, but Anthony Birch did something where... Do we care about Far Cry 2 spoilers?
It's quite a long time ago now.
Yeah, I think
I'm interested in that. You mean I've completed it multiple times. I don't remember there being anything strange.
So apparently your friends betray you, your buddies.
Yeah.
And so... Anthony starts on this assumption, knowing it's going to happen, and tries to kill... If you kill a buddy, then they just get a new one. So he has to systematically kill everybody before the end of the game so that none of them can betray him.
Yeah, I wonder if you can do that. Can you... I mean, does he actually go out of his way to kill them? Because, I mean, there's only a certain number that you can possibly encounter, surely, given the number of missions there are. Are the number of buddies there exactly the number of missions that you have? So there's always one for each possible mission, regardless of how many die along the way, or...
I feel like there's only like about 8 buddies or something. Yeah.
So can you run out of buddies?
Yeah, presumably.
Because the buddies only ever give you like extra missions on the way to other missions, right?
So,
interesting.
You can also just like
the psychology of that game, because it's I think I've talked about it before on the podcast, but it's kind of a weird like the way the game mechanics encourage you to do different things is antithetical to the narrative and antithetical to what you're expecting as a gamer, wanting to get more content. And also, yeah.
My buddy sent me on a mission that was so awful and so pointless that when at the rendezvous where I met her, I stabbed her with my knife, and then when she's lying bleeding on the ground, just ran over her again and again with my car, and she died. It's like without saying a word, and then just drove off.
You're a terrible man. Although
our relationship,
probably
it was a really bad mission. The mission was like to destroy the water supplies or the medical supplies to fuck over everyone over in a village, and it nearly got me killed because it was an ambush. So it was like you literally just betrayed me and tried to hurt.
This is exactly it. The game's saying, here's some extra content for you. Don't you want to play the content? And also, don't you want to be friends with this person? And actually, the person that you want to be friends with is a dickhead.
Yeah.
And the mission that they're asking you to do is not only morally reprehensible, but it's a total cock as well. Yeah. And it's likely also to inevitably endanger the life of the person who's given it to you. So if you really wanted to be a friend with them, you wouldn't actually go their mission, and then you would save their life. But then that's...
Looking at some interesting friendships in real life, I think.
Yeah, no, like, I think that's the reason to like it.
If I knocked on your door, Marsh, and said, do you want to go punch moving cars? You'd be a better friend to me by saying, no, Chris, I don't want to.
Yeah, although maybe I'd be doing the world a service by saying, yes, Chris, and then pushing you in front of a car, which is kind of how it works in Far Cry 2.
Right. Yeah, no, that's fine, yeah.
Is that an accident, or do they intentionally design... abhorrent and annoying missions on the side.
Yeah, the missions always go wrong. They're always morally abhorrent, and it always puts the person who gave the mission to you in mortal peril.
Ah.
So it's a really weird conflicting decision, but I think it works really well.
It's kind of interesting.
I also enjoy how many times we said the word buddy.
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 Buddy. Love the word buddy. Makes me think of Dante.
Sanchez, yeah. We used to be buddies.
You were one buddy.
Link to that in the show notes, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Do some more Sanchez impressions, Chris. You're good at them.
I don't have a bomb on the spot now.
Oh.
I would do, but I'm really nervous and frightened. Maybe after more of this run. Count Elmdor writes, James Bond, Genghis Khan, and Marlon Brando ask you for game recommendations. You must choose one game to satisfy all three.
I have actually a legit good answer for this.
I think I might as well.
I'd make them play Peacemaker, which is a government simulator about the Middle East crisis between Israel and Palestine, and which is obviously... interesting kind of global political level to somebody like Bond. It should be interesting to Marlon Brando, since he had an intent and occasionally possibly anti-Semitic interest in the nature of that conflict. And it would also be instructive, possibly, towards Genghis Khan to see how perhaps he could better the world by making peace with people rather than killing so many of them that the ground remains saturated with the fat of their decomposing corpses for hundreds of years afterwards.
I was going to suggest Roller Coaster Tycoon. James Bond can construct calamitous death traps for him to heroically escape from while being a sexist. Genghis Khan can use it to create a trebuchet so advanced that the West will crumble before the Golden Horde. And Marlon Brando will just enjoy a nice time on a roller coaster, I guess.
Probably by naked and drunk.
Yeah, a roller coaster car named Desire or something.
That was a superb question. That was a really good question. Yeah.
I thought our answers were pretty good as well.
Maybe
people should pay us for them.
Yes.
How much was that worth to you at that moment you just experienced? Was it more than nothing? Zach Forrest writes an equally good question. What? He doesn't say what. He just says,
best gun for shooting people in the head?
Excellent question. Yeah. Excellent.
Mine's the Trank pistol off of MGS3.
Mm. That is good, to be honest.
Is that something that does something different on headshots? Or just trank them faster?
It instantly tranks them. Right. Whereas you get them in the body, it takes a while.
Insta-trank. Mm. Gotta love the insta-trank.
Yeah.
Mine is the .22 from Hitman Blood Money. .22S, which is a pistol that I think... It only comes up like two or three times in the whole game, and it's not one you can buy. You can only find it. And it's not very good. It's a slugging pistol that's just kind of much less accurate than any of yours. I think one of the reasons you can't buy it is it's just not as good as your like silver ballers or whatever. But the sound it makes is superb. It's like a thud noise, which goes thump, instead of the kind of choo choo kind of science pistol. And so partly because of that noise and partly because it's not very good, it's very, very satisfying to, I just like stick with that whenever I possibly can. I'll just use that for everything. So you have to get about as close as you'd need to fireball someone. But then you just draw this pistol from your blazer, shoot them in the back of the head, put it away again, and job done.
I'm a big fan of Deus Ex Human Revolution's silence pistol for the same reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like
thud.
Yeah, no, I actually think of it more of a pleep.
Yeah.
Wow. I thought it was a thud.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like a fleep, really.
I just like the kind of flip, and then man's dead. That sounded like a bleep. There's a plip in it. There's a plosiveness to it.
There's a plip plip plip.
There's a plip plip. There's a plip plip in the feather.
Bit of fricative, bit of plosive. It's a good one, isn't it?
And that's the first year of a linguistics degree.
Excellent. I don't know about first-person shooters, but I love the snipers in Company Heroes 1. Because there is this echoing crack that happens every...
Oh.
Chris just went into his own space there.
Sorry, dumped in the bottle of rum.
His own echoing space.
Tell me about the echoing crack.
I'll tell you all about the echoing crack. It happens every 40 seconds. And the rest of this segment is going to be about destroying Chris with laughter. And every 40 seconds, a man dies in the echoing crack.
What? I'm losing track of what's happening now. This is a sniper rifle.
This is a sniper rifle in Company of Heroes. So you put, there are individual people in Company of Heroes 1, and you plop them into a church or something tall and dramatic, and every 40 seconds you'd hear this across the map, no matter, like, the range of the sound is enormous, and you just know that someone dies. Whenever that sound happens, this echoing kind of crack.
But it takes 40 seconds to, like, reload?
Yes. Wow. It's a balance measure, because it's ludicrous. It's ludicrous, like, Company of Heroes is about chance kills. So if you get these certainty kills, they have to be very spaced out. But yes, that's a very good headshot weapon.
Now joined by podcast special guest.
The moth.
Fuck off, massive moth.
Yeah.
The size of a bat.
Fuck off back to your massive crack, moth.
And that's all the questions we have time for.
On that bombshell.
Yeah.
If you want to send us questions, you can send them to questions@crateandcrowbar.com, and that's the correct address, and we will receive them. You can also post them on our forum, which is crateandcrowbar.com/forum, and you can tweet them at us. We are @crateandcrowbar. And you can also follow us on Twitter individually. I am @pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm @cthurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I'm @PCGLudo. LUDO, and I would like to thank Tom for, as the most sober person, taking control of the end of this podcast.
Control's a strong word.
I'm @MoshDavis, which is DAVIES. And if, as you should, because we have been very good at answering your questions and speaking coherently and insightfully about games.
It's really giving you a hard sell today.
Give us some money, then you can do that on the Patreon. And as you can tell by our high fidelity sound system. We definitely deserve it.
What's the URL for the Patreon, Marsh?
I have literally no idea.
It's patreon.com/crateandcrowbar. Okay. That's right, I'll tell you.
Thanks. And also thanks
for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's how it probably should have sounded the first time we recorded this.